Just about every supermarket these days stocks some imitation meat products, foods that pack plant-derived protein and fat into a form that could be used in place of animal flesh in recipes. Nobody who's had the real thing is going to be fooled by soy-based bacon or tofurkey, but people who choose to avoid meat for ethical or environmental reasons are willing to accept the trade-offs in flavor and texture. But what if we could have our meat and have our animals, too? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Scientists have learned how to grow animal muscle and fat tissue in tanks, starting with just tiny samples of animal cells. Those source cells can reproduce pretty much indefinitely, and better yet, the cow or pig or chicken that provided them doesn't need to be slaughtered to do it. If you think all this sounds expensive and labor-intensive compared to producing meat the old-fashioned way, you're correct. Researchers, though, are trying to perfect formulas that could combine lab-cultivated meat with plant-based meat, and the financial and PR challenges may be greater obstacles than the science. Kenny Torella is a staff writer for Vox's Future Perfect section. His recent article about the future of animal protein as a food source is called Inside the Fantastical Pragmatical Quest to Make Hybrid Meat. Kenny, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris. Thanks so much for having me.
I have to start here with a figure from your piece that kind of stunned me. Americans eat meat at a rate equivalent to 2.4 hamburgers a day. Many of us are eating meat multiple times a day in this country.
That's right. The average American eats about 250 pounds of meat each year. It fluctuates each year, but it's around 250 pounds. And to put that into context, the average European eats maybe 150 pounds, so about 100 pounds less. And there's, you know, even less consumption in, say, Asia or Latin America or Africa. And so in the United States today, we're eating more meat than practically any human society that's ever lived.
But lots of places are trying to catch up, right? Meat consumption is rising around the world.
That's right. Economic growth has really led to increased prosperity around the globe, especially in the global south. And so there's an effort to catch up with American lifestyles, and that includes our high meat consumption rates.
There are consequences to this. How does meat consumption contribute to climate change?
That's right. So the meat that we eat globally accounts for around 15% of global greenhouse gas emissions. And a lot of that simply just comes from beef. Cows burp out a lot of methane. But also, you know, we grow a lot of corn and soy to feed just in the U.S. the 9 billion animals that we eat each year. Most of them are chickens. And so growing all that food emits a lot of carbon for the animals, but then also the animals' waste, and then also throughout the supply chain, you know, processing the animals and transporting the animals also adds to the carbon footprint as well.
So Americans eat 9 billion animals a year. Another pretty stunning number in this piece was that globally we consume 1 trillion animals every year.
That's right. It's about 77 billion land animals, most of them chickens. But when you add in fish and crustaceans, it skyrockets all the way up to an estimated 1 trillion. Some people peg it as high as 3 trillion. It's just really hard to track the number of fish and crustaceans that we eat because they're monitored very well, and also they're usually measured by weight, not by individual. But estimates peg it from 1 to 3 trillion each year globally.
How is it that many people are somewhat bothered, at least, by the mass slaughter of animals, but, you know, many of us manage to ignore that when it comes time to buy groceries or order in a restaurant?
Yeah, so there are some Australian researchers who, around 2010, they coined this term called the meat paradox. And they called it the meat paradox because it kind of exists in all of us. We coexist with two truths. And, you know, one is that we love animals. Most of us have a cat or dog in our home. And if we're, say, you know, face to face with a pig or a cow, we certainly wouldn't want them to feel any harm. But at the same time, most of us have grown up eating a lot of meat, especially if you're in the United States. And so it's part of our culture. It's part of our traditions. and we become accustomed to certain flavors and dishes. And so there's this clash that we often have internally of our love for animals, but also our love to eat them. And it can cause, cognitive dissonance. But despite that, we continue to eat, more and more meat each year.
One more thing I want to get to before we start talking about solutions. Most people know that too much saturated fat, the kind that comes to us from animal products, can be bad for our hearts, our cardiovascular health. But the way most farmed animals are raised also has made some of our medicines less effective.
That's right. About three quarters of all the antibiotics produced in the world are fed to farmed animals. And they're fed to them for two reasons. One is to try to prevent any illness or death, because these factory farms where most animals are raised for food are, can carry a lot of pathogens because the animals are crammed together. So they're fed antibiotics both to try to prevent disease, but in the case of chickens, at least, they're also fed antibiotics to ensure that they grow faster. And antibiotics are a precious part of medicine. 100 years ago, if you had a simple cold or other illnesses, it could have meant severe illness, in some cases, even death. But antibiotics have been really a miraculous advance in medicine. But because we're feeding so much of our antibiotic supply to farmed animals, bacteria on farms are kind of outsmarting the antibiotics that are fed to farm animals. They're becoming resistant to these drugs. And so that's making our antibiotics less effective. And a lot of researchers worry this is just going to get worse, that our antibiotics will become less effective over time, because pathogens on farms will figure out how to resist their effects.
And one of the things people object to scientifically is that often these animals are given antibiotics whether they are shown to be sick or not, right? It's just kind of sprinkled into their food.
That's right. It's not the case that if there's a sick pig or a sick cow, a veterinarian goes and gives them antibiotics. A lot of farmed animals are fed those antibiotics proactively to try to prevent disease.
All right, so what is cultivated meat? How do you produce this stuff from just a tiny amount of actual animal cells?
Yeah, so some of your listeners are probably familiar with plant-based meat, and those are, the veggie burgers you've probably seen in grocery stores for decades. And those are made just simply using ingredients that we're all familiar with: beans, wheat, potato starch, oil, seasonings, and so on. And you can find those at pretty much every grocery store in a growing number of restaurants. But there's another category of what people call meat alternatives or alternative proteins called cultivated meat. You might have heard it described as lab-grown meat or cell-cultured meat. And it's essentially identical to real meat. A lot of the startups that are working on it say it's identical to real meat because it is meat, but instead of it coming from an animal, it's grown from animal cells. And so the way that this is done is startups will take a small biopsy of cells from, say, a cow or a chicken or a pig. It's maybe a couple ounces of cells. And over the course of months, they can grow those, just few ounces of cells into hundreds of pounds of meat. And the way that they get from, A to B, from the sample of cells, the biopsy, to real meat, is by first putting those cells in a bioreactor. You can picture like a large stainless steel tank. And in that bioreactor, the cells are fed, a variety of ingredients. So those can be amino acids, sugars, fats, proteins. And over the course of weeks or months, those cells will grow, they'll proliferate, they'll develop into muscle tissue or fat tissue, and can be harvested from these tanks and turned into meat. And I've gotten a chance to try some of them, and have to say that they tasted very similar to meat from, a real life chicken or cow. And these startups would say it tastes like meat because it is meat, it's just produced in a different way.
So we don't eat birds or mammals at our house, and there's often a bag of like frozen soy-based meat crumbles in our freezer, which are like a pretty good substitute for ground beef. However, if somebody wanted something like a steak or a chicken breast, that's a lot harder to approximate with plant-based meats. Can cultured meat be turned into any form we might crave? Like, could you make something look and sort of behave like a prime rib with cultured meat?
You could. It's a real challenge within this growing cultured meat or cultivated meat sector. And I should, you know, clarify for your readers that this cultivated meat, lab-grown meat, it's not available for sale. Actually, it is available for sale, but only one restaurant in one country, that's in Singapore. So if you're in Texas, it's probably going to be a while until you're going to be able to try these foods. But most of the startups that are making cultivated meat are focused on the most simple version of meat, and that is ground meat, you know, like a ground beef, you know, that you could use for a burger or, you know, mold into something else. But it's much more challenging to create what is called a whole cut meat product, like you were asking about, like creating a steak or a chicken breast. And that's harder because you have to make sure the cells grow in a particular shape. And so there are companies experimenting by essentially growing them onto a scaffold, a plant-based scaffold, so that they grow in the particular shape that they want. But right now, most companies are just trying to make it economically work so they can grow the stuff in the first place. And try to bring their cost down and even just make it technically possible to grow meat from animal cells.
Yeah, at the moment, it's really difficult, right, to crank out these factory-made products at a rate anywhere near that of existing farm and ranch industries.
That's right. Yeah, and our meat, I should add, the meat that you buy from a supermarket or get at a restaurant is artificially cheap. And that's because of a few reasons. So the farming industry in the United States is very lightly regulated. You know, it's very infrequent that farms will be, say, fined or shut down because of water pollution or air pollution, or, you know, will be regulated to emit less greenhouse gas emissions. And it's also rare that, you know, the people who work in slaughter plants are given protections. Slaughter plants are notoriously dangerous places to work. And so for all of these reasons, including, you know, the degradation of animal welfare, meat is really cheap. And also the corn and soy that are fed to farm animals is subsidized by the federal government. And so the companies that are trying to make the plant-based meat products or the cultivated meat products, they have a big uphill battle because they're trying to replace an incumbent product that is so cheap because of significant federal support.
So how does the cost, I mean, I realize these things are only available in very limited ways at the moment, but how does the cost of just producing cultivated meat products compare with buying the very best cut of meat harvested from a slaughtered animal?
So right now, because there's only one company in Singapore selling cultivated meat at just one restaurant, and they've told me that they are losing money on every sale, it's really hard to know exactly how much startups are going to sell these products for and how much it'll cost them to produce them. So it's a bit of a black box. But we do know that it's going to cost much more to make cultivated meat than animal meat, at least for the time being, because they face a number of technical hurdles to not only figuring out how to make it in the first place, but to make it on a larger scale and to do so in a way that is cheaper or maybe cost equivalent to plant-based meat and to also to animal meat.
So people who have had the chance to try this stuff, you know, will say that these products do come a lot closer to animal meat than anything that's just plant-based. One trick to this is that cultivated meat also often contains bioidentical fat. Why is that such a game changer compared to plant-based meats?
Yeah, so if your listeners have ever bought plant-based meat, say, a Beyond Burger or an Impossible sausage product, and they cooked it, sauteed it on the stove, they probably noticed that a lot of the fat leaches out. And that's because most of these products are made using coconut oil or canola oil, which have a really low melting point. So you heat them up and the fat just melts out pretty quickly. And now the special thing about meat from real animals is that their fat has a much higher melting point. So a lot of that fat stays in the product. Fat not only makes food taste better, but it also gives it a better texture. Julia Child, America's favorite chef, was famously quoted saying, "Fat gives things flavor," and she was absolutely right. And so, where hybrid meat comes in, what we're talking about today, is that there are some startups that are trying to do both plant-based meat and cultivated meat at the same time and combine them together for what they call hybrid meat. And a lot of them are really focused on using cultivated fat. So it's real fat muscle, but just grown, in a bioreactor. And they're combining that to the plant-based burgers, kind of like an in-between product, almost like a hybrid car, like a Prius would be to an electric vehicle.
Does that hybrid form make these products potentially more affordable than those that are strictly lab grown?
Yeah, because most of the plant-based meat that you eat out there is made using ingredients that are affordable and abundant, mainly soy or wheat. And so these companies can say, look, we're going to make a product that is 90% plant-based. We're just using wheat and oil and soy and maybe beans. And then just 10% of our product is going to be this really expensive cultivated meat. And so that then gives them the ability to start to slowly introduce these products to the market. Because I think if they were to just try to immediately sell cultivated meat that's 100% cultivated, it's unclear how consumers exactly will feel about it, but it also will be much more expensive.
Part of the reason people may not be sure what they feel about it is, people get really spun up about things that seem unnatural. When you use that term earlier, the container used to produce cultivated meat is called a bioreactor. That's a name that I think presents problems for the PR team for the industry.
I think you're absolutely right. I think one of the biggest challenges that these alternative meat protein producers face is the cultural challenge. A lot of times they're focused just on technical issues. How can we solve this or that problem to make our alternative meat tasty and more affordable? But so much of our perceptions around what we eat is based around culture. It's based around our expectations. And so there's been plenty of interesting blind taste tests where people are told, hey, this is a real meat burger, but it's actually plant-based, and they were none the wiser. They couldn't tell the difference. And so I think the cultivated and the plant-based meat sectors are kind of up against this gut instinct to resist food that is new or novel or high tech, and that they're also up against just the cultural salience of meat. Meat is a major part of not only human identity, but especially American identity, since we eat more than any other country.
Can you think of some reason why Americans in particular are weirded out maybe by the idea of cultivated meat or even hybrid meat, and yet, will inhale Doritos at a backyard picnic, like nobody's business?
Yeah, I think that's kind of the million-dollar question among a lot of these startups. I think one thing we can point to is the fight over GMOs over the last 2 decades, or genetically modified organisms. And so over the last 2 decades, there's been a huge campaign against genetically modified organisms, despite the fact that we do know that they're safe to eat, but there's just kind of a gut instinct, and I don't think it's just unique to Americans. I think it may even be a human trait, that we want our food, and especially, our meat, our animal products, we want to at least think that they come from animals who were, raised in high welfare settings, maybe out on the pasture on old McDonald's farm. But the reality is that the vast majority of meat, dairy, and eggs produced in this country, around 99% or so, come from large industrial scale animal farms that are certainly far afield from the old McDonald's farm we might have in mind when we think about farm animals. And so I think when we look at the GMO fight, we saw that there was a lot of opposition to GMOs and a big push for labeling GMOs, but ultimately it didn't really change consumer behavior. Most people eat foods that were genetically modified, every day, if not at every meal, in some way. And yet, there's also this kind of gut reaction in opposition to anything that's been genetically modified. And so I think it's going to be really interesting to see how consumers respond to these products once they start hitting supermarket shelves.
Kenny, do these cultivated or hybrid meats come with all the nutritional benefits and also potentially nutritional hazards of conventional meat?
When it comes to hazards, they just haven't been produced at scale, and there's not a lot of data. A lot of these startups, their value is in their intellectual property. So there actually is kind of a push within the industry to increase transparency and to ensure that these foods are safe to eat. There's a nonprofit organization called New Harvest that has been bringing a lot of these startups together to share data on how they're producing cultivated meat to ensure that it's safe. And they've been, publishing their research in open access journals. But right now, we just, we don't quite know enough yet to say much one way or the other. When it comes to nutrition, a lot of the startups claim kind of two things. One, that it's, pretty much identical to meat from animal farms. And so they're going to have very similar rates of protein, of saturated fat. And so that's one of their big propositions is that, look, we can deliver, traditional meat, but with a smaller environmental footprint and, a practically non-existent, effect on animals.
So, what do we know about the energy consumption and climate effects? How do the resources needed to produce a pound of hybrid meat compare with producing, say, a pound of beef from cattle?
Yeah, so beef is the most carbon intensive food that there is. If you are worried about climate change and you want to reduce one food product, it should be beef. And so when you look at plant-based meats, they tend to have drastically smaller carbon footprints than beef or, especially pork, and a little better on the environmental footprint than poultry and fish, but not dramatically. And this really just comes down to resources. If you look at what it takes to raise animals for food, it's incredibly resource intensive. You have to feed an animal, give an animal water for their entire life, and you have to run them throughout the entire supply chain from slaughter to the supermarket. And it's incredibly intensive on the environment. Whereas with plant-based meats, you're directly growing crops, and rather than feeding them to farmed animals, you're just putting them into your product. And so the cultivated meat products, there have been some life cycle analyses to look at what their environmental footprint will be. But because these products haven't been commercialized yet, they're more theoretical. We don't know exactly what the carbon footprint will be, but a lot of people speculate that they'll be, much lower than, say, beef or pork or chicken.
Kenny, have the companies working on these hybrid products landed on an ideal ratio of plant ingredients to cultivated cells?
Yeah, well, it varies by company. And so some of these companies are saying, we're going to make our products, 95% plant-based using, say, soy or wheat as the main ingredients, and just a few percent of the cultivated or lab-grown meat sprinkled in. And their big bet is that just a small amount of their cell-cultured meat is going to be good enough to make consumers get excited about meat alternatives in a way that maybe they haven't with the plant-based meats. Now, some are even more aggressive and more excited about the cultivated meat. One startup that I spoke with, Sci-Fi Foods, based in Silicon Valley, California, they are saying that their hybrid burger is about 80% plant-based, but 20% made from cultivated animal cells. And there's also a whole slew of startups that are saying, we don't even want to do the hybrid route. Our chicken nuggets are, 75% made from animal cells and just a little bit of plant product in it.
Sci-Fi Foods, it sounds like they're really leaning into the fact that these might be perceived by people as unnatural.
They are, yeah. And when I asked the CEO, Joshua March, why are you really leaning into it? A lot of the companies have names in which they want to put a positive spin on it or conjure up an image of a farm or more traditional agriculture. And March told me that he thinks transparency is key here. Consumers are smart. They're going to be skeptical and they're going to want radical transparency. They want authenticity. And it's a gamble. I think some people in the field that I've talked to don't like the name Sci-Fi Foods. And then some say it's refreshing that they're being really upfront that, look, we're a product of the future. This is where the food industry needs to head if we're going to tackle climate change, if we're going to work on, reducing our reliance on, say, antibiotics in farming. And so they're really leaning into it as the future of food.
I mean, one could argue that a straighter route to tackling climate change from meat is just all of us eating less. But, as your article implies, we've understood this sort of collectively for some time that meat contributes to climate change, and that has not diminished our appetite for it.
That's right. In the United States, meat consumption continues to go up at a pretty slow rate because we've hit such a high number, about 250 pounds of meat each year. But it's not a law of nature that people just want to eat more and more meat. Interestingly, Germany is a country of all places. It's known for its sausages, and they're actually eating less meat. Their meat consumption has gone down around 12% over the last decade. And Sweden and the Netherlands also seem to be eating less meat. And Europe overall predicts that the continent's meat consumption is going to go down a few percent by the end of this decade. But as you mentioned earlier, when you look at the global south, when you look to Latin America, Asia, Africa, they're eating way less meat than the West. And understandably, they want to catch up. And so we're at a pivotal point in the discourse around food systems in which, rich countries want to, most rich countries want to maintain their high meat diets, and most lower income countries want to catch up. And so a lot of these startups are hoping that they can kind of get in there and be an alternative for, any country that is looking to, lighten its carbon footprint or reduce its toll on animal welfare or the antibiotics issue, like we talked about earlier.
Kenny, who do hybrid meat companies see as the ideal target market for their products? Will they be able to survive and grow with just people who avoid meat now, or are they anticipating folks who have been eating real meat might be willing to make the switch if the products are close enough in taste and texture?
Yeah, so I think that one, these products aren't available yet. A lot of the startups I talk to kind of alluded to this idea that their products might be available in the coming months, or that their competitors might have products in the coming months. Now, I've heard that for years, and so we'll see when the USDA and FDA actually grant regulatory approval to sell cultivated meat or hybrid meats. But I think initially their target demographic are the curious eaters, the adventurous eaters, people who are making their food choices in part based on the environment or on animal welfare or their own health. Now, I think there's a lot of people out there who, want to eat less meat. Poll after poll shows that a significant percentage of Americans, around a quarter to a third, say they want to eat less meat, but they can't quite kick the habit. And so I think these products are aimed at that, quarter to a third of Americans who recognize, okay, there are some issues with our high meat diets. I wish I could eat less, but I haven't really found a product out there that is close to the real thing or is as good enough of a replacement as I'm looking for. And so I think that's their target demographic, at least for now. Of course, in the long run, they hope to get people who just want the real thing to be open-minded to their products as well.
Are you aware of any particular response to this technology from people who have chosen vegan lifestyles? I mean, are these folks still broadly opposed to consuming something identical to animal tissue, even if no animals are gravely harmed?
Oh yeah, from vegans and vegetarians I've talked to about these kinds of products, there's a range of responses. I think some really welcome them because they want there to be more and more alternatives to, traditional, conventionally raised meat, dairy, and eggs out there. And then some, I think look at it with a little bit of skepticism. Maybe they think, okay, I'm not going to eat this stuff, but if other people want to eat it, great. And then I think, there's some overlap between people who are vegetarian or vegan and people who just don't want technology, who don't want to see more technology in our food, in agriculture. And so there's a wide array of responses. You hear some vegans and vegetarians who say, I'll eat it as long as an animal wasn't slaughtered, even if it's real meat, bring it on. And then some kind of view it with skepticism or distaste.
So this didn't come up in the piece, and if you need to just pass on this question, it's fine. But I wonder if these technologies also offer the potential for like cruelty-free dairy products. Will we someday be able to buy something like hybrid milk or lab-grown cheese or butter?
Sure, yeah. So there are some companies working on what is called precision fermentation. And it's kind of like a middle ground between these technologies. And essentially, what they're doing is taking microflora, think of like the culture that you would see on a tub of yogurt. And they're, say, using CRISPR, the gene editing tool, to modify these microflora, these cultures, to produce certain proteins found in, say, milk, like casein or whey. And so this is a way that they're kind of creating the dairy equivalent to cultivated meat, just using different technology. And some of them even actually have products on the market. There's one company called Perfect Day Foods, which sells a variety of different, dairy products from ice cream to milk. And I don't think they're available, mass market in grocery stores, but you can find them here and there. And I think they may also sell online. And then there's also a company called The Every Company that makes essentially an egg alternative using this same technology. And advocates in this space kind of put it all under the umbrella of what they call cellular agriculture. So using these kind of newfangled technologies to make traditional meat, dairy, and eggs.
I have an email here from Rob in McKinney, Texas, who asks, given that there are government-sponsored acts and omissions that make animal-grown meat cheap, is there any organized movement to do away with those subsidies, give workers in the meat industry better wages and working conditions, etc.?
There certainly is. There's a whole constellation of nonprofits that have sprouted up, really over the last 50 years or so that are advocating for a better food system. And now better is subjective. There's some groups that are really focused on, say, the environment and reducing pollution. And maybe they are really focused on trying to get the federal government to regulate air and water pollution from farms. There are some groups focused on worker safety, like Rob mentioned. And then there's some push to reduce the subsidies handed out to farmers. And interestingly, some of that push comes from libertarians, who, just by a matter of principle, don't want businesses to essentially get free money from the government and want the free market to do its job, so to speak. And so, yeah, there's a very large network of groups trying to reform agriculture with using laws and culture change and regulations. And then you have this other group of people who are trying to create technology that can maybe one day replace meat, dairy, and eggs.
I guess I shouldn't have been surprised by this, but I was. Folks who are making hybrid and cultivated meats still have to be really careful to avoid bacterial contamination. How can that happen?
That's right. So, about a year ago, a journalist named Joe Fassler for The Counter, a food news outlet that is now defunct but did great work, he published this really fascinating article that looked at the technical challenges that these cell cultured meat companies face in growing animal cells and turning them into meat and doing so in a way that can be done affordably and produce a large supply. And one of the biggest issues that Fassler found when talking to people who are studying these challenges is that these companies are going to face a big problem with ensuring that there's no bacterial contamination in their facilities. Now, right now, a lot of this is happening in small labs with, in small bioreactors. But a lot of these companies are now moving to pilot facilities, and they hope to one day scale up to big factories. And one of the challenges is that if they are producing a massive amount of cells, there's the fear that they could become contaminated. And so if a batch of cells were, contaminated with bacteria, it would ruin the whole batch. It could cost them hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars. And so a lot of them are hard at work. And actually, one of the startups that is working on these, called Mosa Meat, he said the CEO of that company said this is really top of mind for him. He wrote a detailed article about how they are really trying to ensure that their facilities that are producing these cultivated meat products can be done in a way where that risk is minimized.
Would these products, and I understand that they are not widely commercially available, but would they ultimately probably be inspected by the FDA in the same way that conventional meat producing facilities and products are inspected?
That's exactly right. So the FDA and the USDA, interestingly, are kind of splitting responsibility of the safety and manufacturing of cultivated meat. And so the FDA, like you mentioned, is going to be doing safety checks and inspections, while the USDA is going to be looking more at the processing and distribution of the products.
All right, I want to go to the phones. We have Michael on the line in Dallas. Hi, Michael.
Hello. I had a quick question. I know that there's been genetic engineering done on species of grains and probably animals for decades, where they'll grow a particular strain of corn or whatever. What's the difference between a GMO and just the result of decades of genetic engineering?
Thanks for calling.
Yeah, that's a great question. So, if you want to, if you're a researcher or a food company and you want to make an animal or a plant, have a certain trait, usually for food companies, that means they want a crop or an animal to grow bigger or faster. There's two main ways to do it. One way to do it, which has been kind of the route that I'll talk about animals first here. The main route to do that is called selective breeding. And so you're not editing their genomes, but you're taking, you know, maybe two chickens that are known for growing bigger or faster, whatever trait you want them to have, and crossbreeding them, and continually doing that until eventually you have a chicken or a pig or a cow that grows much bigger and faster. And so the chickens of today that we eat grow dramatically faster than the chickens that our grandparents ate. And it's actually really affected their welfare, but it's made them grow also much bigger and faster. And the same thing applies to plants. But there's also, just as we've seen a rise in the genetic modification of plants, there's also a rise in gene editing farmed animals. So not just crossbreeding them, like I mentioned with chickens, but actually taking certain traits from, you know, one animal and introducing them into the genome of another animal. That's called, I believe, transgenetic engineering. But now researchers are also using CRISPR to just go in and make edits to an animal's genome. And so I actually wrote an article about this around a year ago. And there's a lot of debate over whether this kind of, you know, gene editing of farmed animals is good or bad, because they could make the animals grow bigger and faster, and that could affect their welfare. But they could also grow them to be, gene edit them to be resistant to certain diseases, which would be good. They would suffer less. And so I think the conversation and the issues around genetically modifying food, it's only going to become a bigger and bigger conversation as we try to figure out how to, you know, grow enough food to feed 10 billion people by 2050. And that's part of the conversation here with trying to grow, say, cultivated meat or make plant-based meat in a way that is more efficient than traditional animal agriculture.
Does that efficiency include less wasted material generated for every ounce or pound of hybrid meat that finds its way to a table compared with conventional meat?
Yeah, so when you look at the animal farming industry, you know, one researcher told me that about 20% of all protein is lost to disease. And so if you look at any sector of animal agriculture, whether it's chickens or pigs, you know, maybe 5 to 30% of animals die before they reach the slaughterhouse. So there's a lot of waste. And now when you look at, say, hybrid meat or plant-based meat, there's going to be less waste. Of course, you know, you might have a bad harvest, you might have a flood that destroys crops. But there's a lot of people out there arguing for, you know, a plant-based meat supply or a hybrid meat supply, because it can increase food security. In many ways, it's a little less risky than dealing with, you know, living animals who can be subject to, you know, disease and mortality.
Kenny Torella is a staff writer for Vox's Future Perfect section. His recent article about the future of animal protein as a food source is called Inside the Fantastical Pragmatic Quest to Make Hybrid Meat. Kenny, this is so interesting. Thanks for making time for us.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and you can subscribe to our podcast free wherever you get your podcasts. For all of that, just search for KERA Think or catch us on the website think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.